From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. We'll also talk about the prophet Edgar Cayce. Here's what's happening. The eyes of Texas turned into an emerging water crisis after electrical power had been restored to nearly 2 million homes, though hundreds of thousands of residents remain in the dark there. About 13 million Texans, so that's nearly half of the state's approximately 29 million residents, were under an advisory to boil their drinking water. All of this because of the low record temperatures that damage infrastructure and pipes. Folks are getting blasted out there. And as winter storms sweep through the U.S., you may be using your snowblower more than ever now. And if it's made by Toro, it's time to check your model number. The company is recalling 6,700 Toro PowerMax 826 snow throwers with the model number 37802. I'll say that again, 37802. Why? Because of an amputation hazard. According to the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, the snowblowers were sold nationwide and online by Home Depot, Ace Hardware, and Toro authorized dealers between November 2020 and January 2021 for around $1,200. Please be careful. The high risk, they say, of injury and amputation. Johnson & Johnson has announced that it has submitted its coronavirus vaccine to the World Health Organization for emergency use listing. The vaccine, which is administered in a one-dose jab, is also pending emergency use authorization from the FDA. Amid the dire COVID warnings, one crucial fact has largely been ignored. Cases are down 77% over the past 6 weeks. If a medication slashed cases by 77%, we'd call it a miracle. Why is the number of cases plummeting much faster than the experts have predicted? Nobody really knows, except maybe herd immunity is kicking in. Christian Weil, of course, myheartbook.com with us here with his weekly report. What do you have for us, Christian?
Hey, George, you remember in 1983, Ann Murray had a hit song called We Sure Could Use a Little Good News Today.
Yes, we can.
Well, finally, we come to a possible crossroads in this pandemic. The good news today, George, is that the statistics support a departure from the grim numbers we have had to report over the past year. A remarkable 64% drop, or what did you just say, 70?
77%.
77% drop in new cases and a 23% drop in COVID hospital admissions at mid-January. It all points to several factors, like those who have had the virus and recovered with protective antibodies, as well as the millions being vaccinated and those declining numbers since the huge surge following the holiday get-togethers. Incidentally, the news from Bloomberg and CDC in their polling show that the number of people agreeing to be vaccinated has now jumped from 40% to 70%, and according to the CDC, out of 30 million vaccinations, no one has died as a result. But the best news moving forward, George, I think, is Dr. Fauci's optimistic prediction that we could possibly be reaching herd immunity in the United States in the early fall if 70% of the nation is vaccinated. To see an ultimate end of this virus, however, the entire world must reach herd immunity as it did in 1920. But if anybody is thinking wearing a mask is something new, well, seeing is believing. This morning I posted on my site some actual remarkable photographs I had located from 1918 when the only protection anyone had was the mask. In these photos, over 100 years ago, everyone, including two-year-old children, were wearing them. And this was before George Norrie and Coast to Coast was around to keep the public informed.
Well, I got to tell you, let me ask you this, too. If we don't all get vaccinated, I don't plan to take it. I've just never taken the flu vaccine either. What happens? What happens if we stay status quo right now?
Well, in 1920, during the Spanish flu epidemic, 40 million people died worldwide before herd immunity burned the virus out. In other words, with no vaccinations, they weren't invented back then, no antibiotics, it was person to person until it had spread so dramatically and broadly that the virus could not find somebody new to infect. They had already built antibodies from previous infections.
All right, my friend. Christian Wiles, website, myheartbook.com. You know, we've done some stories on dolphins, the incredible mammals, and dolphins have developed a number of similar personality traits to humans despite having evolved in vastly different environments. According to researchers, a study published in the Journal of Psychology looked at 134 male and female bottlenose dolphins from 8 facilities all around the world, and each dolphin's personality being assessed by the staff at the facilities. The results of the study found that a convergence of certain personality traits, especially curiosity and sociability. Isn't that incredible? What a story. Kevin Randall's with us now for his weekly UFO report. What's happening in the skies, Kev?
Hey, George, how's it going?
Okay, I'm pretty good.
Well, tonight I've assembled a compilation of sightings from a variety of sources, including Fran Ridge and NICAP, Peter Davenport and his National UFO Reporting Center, and, of course, MUFON.
Perfect.
First up, there's a video that shows a cigar-shaped object that was recorded on a home video camera in Montana recently. Although this is probably a meteor, it is flying in a fairly flat trajectory, and if you look closely, you can see the turbulence in the air behind it. But I don't have many additional details. For those who are interested, I'll post a link to it on my blog, and they can take a look at it a little later. In an unrelated sighting on June 19, 2018, the witness was driving in Moscow Mills, Missouri, when he saw an object hovering to his right. He thought it was gray and white blimp. He watched as it started to move off to the right rapidly. The object then shifted to the left and disappeared when a jet flew up close to it. The next sighting, also from Missouri, came just under 30 minutes later when the witnesses, while traveling on the Stracta Church Road, spotted a large blip-like object over a tree line. They kept driving, and at the top of the next hill, again saw the object before it dropped behind the trees. It tangled my own syntax there once in a while. The blimp, or what has once been called a cigar-shaped craft, was dull, metallic-colored, and it was estimated between 400 and 600 feet long and about 100 feet tall. One of the witnesses managed to take a single picture on his cell that he said wasn't very good. The object finally disappeared. The sighting lasted between 4 and 5 minutes. A similar sighting took place in Camel, New York on June 16, 2018. The witness described the object as thinner than a blimp, but fatter than a cigar-shaped craft. There were no wings visible, no windows or portholes, and it was flying low enough that such features would have been visible. The witness said that he could see a ribbed features, and he thought it was something man-made, but it seemed to be primitive. He watched it as it flew over his car slowly. He could hear no noise, and it even turned down the volume on his radio and rolled down the windows so that he could determine if there was any sound. All he heard was the normal background traffic noises. On December 9th, 2020, just a couple of months ago, the witness, driving in Greenfield, Indiana, said that he spotted some bright lights northeast of him. The object had 5 lights in a rectangular shape across the front, and it was about 300 yards across. The object was hovering over a barn. Once he arrived at home, he decided to try to find more about it. He walked to a trail and came to a point near where he'd seen the object. It came back into view, but this time he said the lights were white and were in a vertical orientation rather than a rectangle. He said it just faded until it was invisible. There was a Madar sighting in the area, but it was more than 9 hours earlier, which means it might not have been related to the sighting at all. In an interesting, if not somewhat confusing, sighting on March 12, 2020, a witness in Troy, Ohio, reported he had taken pictures of a UFO but wasn't happy with the results. He said he went to chase it in his car, and it began moving rapidly. He said at first it seemed to be flying about 50 miles an hour and under 1,000 feet. It had a definite, sharp edge and was triangular-shaped. He said the pictures didn't do justice to the object. Others in Ohio suggest it's becoming a hot spot, and there have been many UFO videos that have been taken there recently. I have a link to the various stories, as well as the videos about the sightings at my blog, which is www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com. And that's it for tonight, George.
Okay, my friend, we'll talk to you next week. Kevin Randall, tracking UFO reports for us. Up next, he's back, the greatest storyteller ever born. Lionel Fanthorpe joins us live from the United Kingdom in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. You're going to enjoy the next couple hours. Sit back, or if you're driving, be careful, but lay back and listen to Lionel Fanthorpe. Lionel was born in England, has worked as a journalist and teacher. He's been the director of media studies at Cardiff Academy, a fully ordained Anglican priest working for the church in Wales. He has been the president of the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. Very popular television and radio presenter, celebrity guest on chat shows as well. Author of well over, how many now, Lionel? 250 books at least?
Yep, that's about right. I don't know the exact number, but 250 is good enough to be where we should be.
And you're 86 years old now?
Yep, I was on February the 9th, just gone. Was my 86th birthday.
Well, good for you. Happy birthday. How have you been? How's Patricia? How's everybody?
Well, Patricia and our wonderful daughters and grandchildren are all fine, I'm delighted to say. I have been a remarkably lot better than I expected, because way back in 2006, I had some mysterious chest pains, got diagnosed with a thing called arrhythmia, where the heart, for some reason, decides to change speed. So you can be doing 50 beats a minute, 1 minute, and then suddenly it decides it's going to have a jump and you're doing nearly 200. And they fitted me with a magnificent gadget called an ICD unit, which is an internal cardiac defibrillator. And if you look like going at a silly speed, this little electronic gadget cuts in and brings you back to a proper speed. And thanks to that, 14 years after, I'm still here and still very happy and still enjoying life.
Well, good for you. Our doctors, especially Doc Wallach, would tell you, Lionel, that it's probably some kind of electrical situation, maybe as a result of the spine. Let me ask you a question about that. Did you find that the heart rhythm went back to normal after you did some deep, slow breaths?
Yes. Yes, absolutely right, George. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you just relax and breathe deeply, and within a couple of minutes, you'll be where you should be.
Yep, there's something to it. Well, I'm going to throw some subject matters your way, and you can tell us the stories, okay?
Do my best.
And by the way, what's your latest book? When's the last one you wrote?
The most recent one to be published. I've got a list, because I'm back writing again as hard as I can go.
Good for you.
I've got, of what's written, Joan of Arc Mysteries is one of the most recent, and that's also the one that I'm really proud of, delighted with, is called Parables from the Pond, which features a guy who is my alter ego. He is the Reverend Dr. Hugh John Green. And when you run Hugh John Green together, it becomes huge and green, and he is a gigantic frog from the kingdom of frogdom, and he's also a vicar, so he's a combination of a priest and a soldier, and the bad guys are the rats, and Hugh organizes the warrior bullfrogs, who are called the Web Guard, who keep the innocent, helpless animals safe from the bad guys. And my illustrator for that is a wonderful American friend who is Rick Sedita, and he does all the pictures of the frogs. And we get on wonderfully with that. We just love the Hugh John Green stories.
Well, that's great. Yeah, but 12 years ago, you and I talked about time travel. Has time travel changed yet?
Well, I think that the theories that we went over then are still as important and as interesting as they were 12 years ago. And one of the things that always comes to my mind when we're talking about time travel is Leonardo da Vinci. Because Leonardo produced some incredible stuff, which seemed almost as if
he had been a time traveler.
Yes.
That the Leonardo that we know of in history was not necessarily the same man who was born as Leonardo da Vinci. That he may have, either that, or there's another theory, that among all Leonardo's brilliant inventions, he had a time machine, and he went forward to our time, then back to his own time, and took things like his helicopter were not things he invented, but things he had seen in the future.
Yeah, he had some gift to come up with those kinds of innovative ideas, and the depictions are exactly what they turned out to be now.
Yes, yeah, that is what is so amazing. It's what makes me think that they were not so much inventions as observations by a brilliant man, and they were so accurate and so detailed. Exactly as you said, George, that's what we've got now, and it doesn't seem irrational to suggest that Leonardo time traveled to our century, saw and noted, and then went back to his medieval times. And some of the pictures he drew, I don't think they could have been drawn unless you'd actually seen one.
Have you seen that slate picture of Abydos in Egypt that has and it depicts a helicopter? And this is, you know, several thousand years ago at least. It's got a submarine in it. It's incredible.
Yeah, it is. And one of the other things that struck me as very interesting in the last three or four days was the little bronze statue, which actually has a 2021 hairstyle. It's almost as though somebody had, the sculptor who had created that was either a time traveler from our century or that he'd gone forward. It's found on the Isle of Man, just off the coast of Britain. And it just looks as if it's been modeled on one of our guys who's just come out of the hairdresser. And it really is amazing.
I don't know if you ever saw the picture of, it was taken in the 1800s, and it's a crowd of people on the street and on the sidewalks of, let's say, New York. And they're dressed in 1800 garb, obviously. It's a picture from that era. And in the foreground, you see a guy clearly holding up what could be a cell phone to his ear back in the 1800s, and it looks like he's chatting to somebody. And I looked at that picture and said, well, there were no cell phones in the 1800s. There were no towers. And even if he was a time traveler, the phone wouldn't work in that era. But it was a remarkable picture. Did you see that?
Yeah, I've seen it. And I would agree with you. It is a truly amazing thing. What is he holding to his ear? And what some theorists have come up with the idea is that it was a very early attempt, that he was one of them from their period, and he was attempting to record sound, and that it was an attempted recording rather than an attempted communication, that he had sort of worked on the idea that if you can fossilize living creatures or plants or anything else, then maybe you could, in some strange way, fossilize sound, and that there were some stones which had curious ability to, you pick one up, and often at the seaside where it's been rolled up and down along a stony beach, and you can pick it up and there is some sort of noise reverberating from inside the stone. And that's one of the theories about what he's holding.
Lionel, when we come back after the break, let's talk about Deja Vu, Spring-Heeled Jack, and some other remarkable stories that you have been following. We'll get into voodoo and have some fun. And then, of course, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines while we'll still be chatting with Lionel about his stories. We'll let you ask him a question or two about some of the things that he's been working on. All that and much more. A couple of his books include Mysteries of Templar Treasure and the Holy Grail, Unsolved Mysteries of the Sea. We will be back in a moment with the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe, in just a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Lionel Fanthorpe with us, the greatest storyteller ever born. We're going to open up the phone lines with Lionel next hour as well as we continue chatting with him. And wait till you hear some of the stories we're going to talk about when we come back in just a moment. Tim Banal, of course, is our news editor of Coast to Coast AM, and he puts on In Coast You Missed It stories on the website, and he's got some great ones for us tonight. Hi, Tim. Welcome back.
Hey, George. Good to talk to you again.
You too. You really do. You posted some dandies this time. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, folks can check this out in the number one spot in the carousel. This one's pretty cut and dry, just pure nightmare fuel for the Coast listeners. A woman, she's walking through a wooded area in England. It's sort of a notorious forested area known as Cannock Chase. Kind of like the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. It's a bit of an oversimplification, but you know what I mean. That's a kind of reputation to it. So she's walking through the forest, happy to get out from the coronavirus lockdown over in England, getting some fresh air. She stumbles upon what can only be described as an altar consisting of dolls. Just dozens of dolls fastened to trees in a circle. I know. Really, really creepy stuff.
Creepy.
With what looks to be a Ouija board in the middle of this altar. Yeah. And there's video. So if folks want to see, like I said, it's nightmare fuel, but it's a lot of fun to watch. So if you want to see a video of this doll altar, that's in the number one spot in the castle. No one knows really what it is, really. Is it some kind of thing for a ritual or a prank? Either way, it's pretty wild. Now, the other story, I'm noticing a theme here, because last time I was on, we talked about a fake murder. I don't understand why people have a compunction to report fake murders, but we got another one here.
Jeez.
I know, and this one's definitely a do-not-try-this-one-at-home, folks, especially with the a lot of people. It's been snowing here in Boston for about the last 4 days, so I can empathize with this man here in the Ukraine. A gentleman unnamed, he lives in the village of Grybova, Rudnya. Big storm hit the town. And the whole neighborhood hadn't been plowed out for days. So he's snowbound. He's stuck in the house. Finally, he's had enough. And he comes up with what has to be the worst idea I've ever thought of to get cleared out. He calls the emergency hotline, the 911 of Ukraine, and he tells them that he has just murdered his stepfather. And he is he paints a whole grisly picture of this killing, and he is so overcome with grief that he wants to turn himself in to the police. But, unfortunately, in order for them to come and take him into custody, they're going to need to plow the road to properly get to his house to arrest him. So his bright idea, he thinks, to finally get the street plowed in front of his house. A bit of karma, I guess, as quote-unquote luck would have it. He hangs up the phone. He's waiting for the cops to show up and plow the road. What comes down the road, George? A tractor with a plow on it.
Here we go.
Clears out the road. And now I'm sure he's biting his fingernails worrying, because next thing you know, right after the plow, down the road come the cops. And they have no problem getting to the house, knock on the door. He's there. Of course, the stepfather's there, perfectly fine. And they charge him with filing a false police report. So there you go. Do not try this one at home, folks.
I love those stories. Thanks, Tim. That's Tim Banal, our news editor of CoastToCoastAM.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with the greatest storyteller ever born, Lionel Fanthorpe. I gave you that title, Lionel. It stuck, didn't it?
It did indeed, George, and I am eternally grateful. It's a lovely title, and you honored me very much.
We have a million things to talk with you about. I want to get into Spring-Heeled Jack in a moment, but tell us about your thoughts on Deja Vu. What do you think that is?
Well, it ties in, I think, with this whole mystery of time travel. And there are occasions when it seems that the human consciousness, the mind, the soul, the spirit, whatever we like to call the real personality inside every man and woman, that can move
independently of the body through which it normally operates and which it normally controls. So that there are occasions when it appears to go forward, and of course this raises a second enormous question, but I'll come to that in a second, that we appear to go forwards in time to have a preview of an experience, and then when that experience comes up in the normal time stream, then we say, hey, I know what's going to happen. I've seen all this before.
It's weird. It's a weird feeling. And sometimes it's almost euphoric, isn't it?
It is. It is. And on these occasions when we think we have foretold the future, or we've seen an event that is like, it seems also to be possible to avert. It's almost as if it comes to us as a warning that someone or something out there in the great mysterious psychic, spiritual, invisible universe is able to take us forward and warn us that if we pursue conduct X, Y, or Z, then this is likely to happen. It's almost like being on board ship and you're getting a glimpse of the rocks on the coast or of a storm coming towards you. And you can therefore, as a skilled navigator, you can take steps to try to avoid the worst of it. And of course, the second thing, which I feel philosophically and theologically is very, very important, is that if we can glimpse the future, if the people that we sometimes refer to as seers can glimpse a future, is that future fixed? And of course, if it is, well, there goes free will, there goes the chance to choose what we want to do. Are we just actors playing out a role that's been written for us? And is what we call life the stage on which we are acting? Or do we really have choices? Let's think of something practical concerning us. I love coming on your shows. I'm glad I'm well enough to do it again.
Me too. But,
thank you very much, Sean. You're very kind. But is it preordained that you and I should talk on your show this morning, or could you make the choice of inviting me and I make the choice of saying, yes, please, George, I'd love to? And this whole difficulty about whether there is a set pattern which is being, you know, we're just being towed along like the, like the buggy on the train, or do we really stop at every split second and choose whether I am now going to have a boiled egg for my breakfast, or I'm now going down to the newsagent's shop to buy my morning paper, or... And you see, that question is so enormous. If we're not free, how can we be moral?
When we take calls with you next hour, I'd love for people who have had deja vu experiences to check in with you, Lionel, just to see how big this is. I think it's pretty widespread, don't you?
I do. And it's, if I can go back to just one little personal episode.
Sure.
In 1952, I wrote the first of my stories. But in 59 and 60, I was doing about one book a week. And
my God.
Over under 100 of those. And these were all my early science fiction and fantasy stories. Now, an amazing publisher called Wordcatcher, I mean, there's a name you can't forget.
Exactly.
Came to me recently, that's more than 50 years after I wrote these, and asked, could he now reproduce that whole 100 titles that I wrote back in the 50s and 60s? And you think, well, man, I'm 86. When am I going to get another chance like this?
Do it.
So all the old stuff that I did for Spencer's, John Spencer's Badger books, things like Hyperspace, World of the Gods, Destination Moon, Alien from the Stars, Menace from Mercury, all those old paperbacks that I did then, they're all coming out again brand new with WordCatcher. And I just, had I had a preview of that when I was writing them over 60 years ago, that when I was, shall we say, a senior citizen in my 80s, that somebody would want to do them all again, the whole set, the whole 100 and odd.
Maybe you could get 100 or 200 million like Bob Dylan got for his music library that he just sold, or the Beach Boys just sold their entire library as well. Maybe you could sell yours.
Yeah, well, this is a wonderful publisher, and he's bringing them all out again, and so I get my when the new ones are sold, I get my royalties again.
I love it. In the 1900s, there was a story out of Versailles, France, of Miss Moberly and Miss Jourdain. What was that story?
Oh, yes. Now, this was amazing. The Moberly-Jourdain story is probably one of the most likely episodes to have been real time travel.
Mm.
They were walking, they saw this very attractive young lady in the wood as they walked through. And she, of course, was not dressed in the style that they were, but in the, in the 2 centuries earlier. And it's an absolutely amazing, amazing thing.
Who was the time traveler? The lady in the garb?
Well, it looked as if they thought, as they looked at various pictures afterwards, that somehow either they had traveled back to her period, and it was allegedly Anne Boleyn who they saw.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that it's from that period.
One of Henry's the girls, right?
Yes, yes. And there's
she got beheaded, I think, didn't she?
Yeah, and another theory was that it was Marie Antoinette who they saw.
My God!
And when they were in the Petit Trianon, they thought that they had seen her. That's where they were walking when it happened. And it really was astonishing. They recounted in the book that they'd written that they were visiting the palace at Versailles, and it was August the 10th, 1901, and they took the train to Versailles, and they were decided to walk through the gardens of the Petit Trianon, but when they reached the Grand Trianon, they found it was closed to the public. And they got their Baedeker guidebook with them, but after missing the turn to their main avenue, they entered a lane where they bypassed their original destination. And Moberly reported that she then noticed a woman who was shaking a white cloth out of a window. And Miss Jourdain recalled noticing an old, deserted farmhouse, outside of which stood an old-fashioned, outdated plow. And they had a great feeling of, well, sort of oppression and dreariness. And then they reported reaching the edge of the wood, close to the Temple d'Amour. And crossing that was a man who was by the garden kiosk. He was wearing a cloak, big shady hat, and Moberly said that his appearance was repulsive and his expression was odious, though those were her exact words. Now, looking at time travel, which is our main concern, George,
mm-hmm.
Did the people in that Petit Trianon from the earlier date, 200 years before, did they move forward, or did Moberly and Jourdain move backwards, finding themselves in the Petit Trianon at that time? So with time travel, we've always got those two really irreconcilable concepts and questions to ask. Has the past come forward to our day when we view people and things from the past, or have we gone back so that we are, I mean, if any of them could, I often wonder whether a great many of the ghost stories that are faithfully recounted are actually time travel, and that somebody from our century has gone back three or four centuries and been seen indistinctly and vaguely and weirdly, and the people who were living then say, you know, is that a demon or an angel, or is it a ghost? And the question remains unresolved.
It does.
Who's gone forward? Who's gone back?
What do you think of spells and curses? Real?
I would suggest as a broad answer that we don't really know, even with all our modern medical science, just quite how powerful the effect of the mind on the body can be. And when we read of cases of great spiritual healers, well, like Jesus himself, when the sick person is told by a reputed healer that all is well, then that person can start a mental process which will control the physical illness and restore health. So that it's the power of mind over matter, which if only we could spend more time, if our scientists could spend more time studying it, that when somebody is, you see, let's think of a sort of wartime condition, and a man's been badly wounded in the trenches, and there's nobody there to help him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, with a terrible series of wounds, he will get out of that trench. He's telling himself, let's imagine he's got a beautiful young wife and two young children that depend on him, and he's got to get back from that military situation to look after the people he loves. And he does amazing things inside his head, and that badly wounded body will work because of the power of his mind and his desire to recover for people he loves.
His determination. But if somebody has put a spell on you or a curse and you don't know it, you don't know it, how can you fight it off? How can you defend yourself?
That's a tremendous question, George. If you don't know that they've done it, does it have any power within itself?
Think about that. We're going to take a break, Lionel. We'll come back and do that. Then, of course, we've got to hear your Spring Heel Jack story, and then we'll take phone calls, questions for Lionel Fanthorpe, or I'd like you to talk about your deja vu experience. Has it happened to you? Back in a moment with the greatest storyteller ever born.